There's a contrast between the full moon and the sun being too hot to look at. But the moon is kind of refreshing. And I think it's fairly common for people to kind of stop for the full moon when it's really clear and large. It can be kind of compelling sight. A lot of things, kind of sense of awe or stillness or peace. And the full moon is a symbol for the same qualities in the mind. The mind which is peaceful, is luminous, is full. The heart which is complete, hanging unobstructed in the sky of awareness. Independent. And we say in English, there's a full moon, and there's the half moon, and the new moon. But the remarkable thing is that the moon is always full. There are times when the moon doesn't appear because it's hidden by clouds and hidden by whatever. But the moon, even so, is still always full. And so the same way with our own awakened nature, our own awakened heart, our own selves, that it's possible to understand that it's always full. It's always peaceful, luminous, independent, floating in the endless sky. Except that sometimes there are clouds that cover it. Sometimes from our perspective, maybe we only see part of it. But I think when you have a sense of the possibility of a mind, a heart that's free, that's luminous, peaceful, like the full moon, it can be quite compelling. The kind of thing that people stop for, or attracted to, or in awe of. It can be quite refreshing. Buddha's practice is understood to be inclining or leading onwards to our plunging into that peaceful nature. There's an expression of plunging in to freedom or to nibbana. I love that expression, to plunge in. Partly because it means all of us goes in. We don't hold ourselves back. It's so complete and so thorough. And there's also a kind of a surrender or letting go. Probably have the experience of being at the edge of a pool or lake or something, and you put your toe in and it seems a bit cold. And you're standing there kind of waiting and waiting and waiting for something inside of you to decide it's okay to jump in. And then finally you take the plunge. But maybe it takes 5-10 minutes, kind of psych yourself up to plunge into peace. The idea of refuge is is sometimes likened to being a cave or a shelter. You have a cave or a shelter to protect yourself. And it can seem that the idea of refuge is a kind of withdrawal from the world, from activities, whatever. But that's not at all, I think, what it's meant to be. I think that the idea of refuge is meant to be a support, an orientation that helps us engage in the world. It's a way of being in the world, not a way of withdrawing from the world. And it can seem that the world that we live in can be meaningless sometimes, or confusing, or challenging in many ways. And going for refuge is to, in some way, bring order or definition or clarity, understanding of what our relationship is to this world that we're living in. It's a kind of a, gives us an orientation of knowing how we are going to be in the world. It kind of support of how to live in this life that can be so confusing and so difficult. So rather than a withdrawal from the world, it offers us a way to be in the world when we're uncertain about all other things. Even in times of great crisis, the refuges are sometimes the only thing that can be a source of support and orientation and tell us how to step forward, how to go ahead in living in this life. The word for dharma, the word dharma, has the ancient Theravada commentaries love to point out that the word dharma comes from the root word, meaning of it, dhur, means to uphold, to hold up, to support. And that which holds up our life and supports our life so we don't fall down into states of misfortune, hold up our life so that we're somewhat protected from many of the misfortunes that could befall us. And really the primary misfortune that Dharma practice protects us from is ourselves. There's a Tibetan teacher by the name of Chogyam Trungpa who once said that, I was asked, you know, what is the refuge protecting you from? And he said, from yourself. And the understanding of that is that whatever happens in life, we add to the difficulties, we add to the suffering by the way in which we relate to that. If we relate to it with greed, we'll suffer. If we relate to it through hate, we'll suffer. If we relate to it through fear, we'll suffer. If we relate to it through confusion, we'll suffer. And the refuges and the Dharma are meant to give us a way to know how to engage in the world, to know how to step forward into the world free of greed and hate, fear and delusion, and to uphold us, support us in doing that. It's said in the ancient commentaries that one of the primary functions of the refuges is to free us from fear. They say in much more dramatic terms, they say the function of the refuge is to destroy fear. And what is fear? You know, where are the roots of fear? Within ourselves. What is it that's within ourselves that obstructs, that hides the luminous nature of our own mind, our own hearts? How is it that we interfere with the fullness of our being so that rather than stepping forward into the world with confidence, with peace, with kindness, with love, we step forward with fear or apprehension or confusion? So one of the primary functions of Dharma practice and refuge is to help us, give us the tools, give us the orientation, give us support and the confidence to keep looking back at ourselves to see where is it that I'm obstructing the fullness of my nature? Where is it I'm obstructing the possibility of peace? The insight of the Buddha, the great insight of the Buddha, was the insight into the ways in which we complicate our lives unnecessarily. So there is a very personal, individual aspect, individualistic aspect of Dharma practice and teachings of the Buddha. Not to be self-centered in the practice, but the individualistic approach is beginning to take responsibility for the way in which we relate to the world around us. and not to take the world around us as what defines our happiness and unhappiness. It's said that sometimes that once a person has gone for refuge, they no longer have any reason to complain about the world. I mean, of course, there's all kinds of things that shouldn't be the way they should be. That's for sure. But you can't, you know, the world is not a place then to... going for refuge gives a certain kind of order to the world, gives kind of a certain kind of place for where you are in the world. Even if things are terrible in the world, you know where the source of your practice is. You know where the practice is. To start here in your body, in your hearts, in your minds, and understand really clearly, look at how is it that you contract, you resist? How is it that you add suffering to yourself and to others around you by how you act? One of the beautiful aspects of going for refuge is that refuge is not simply something for ourselves, something we receive, but also refuge is something we need to give, we offer. So there's a kind of reciprocity in giving and receiving refuge, going for refuge, and then being someone who offers refuge then to the world around us. If we can learn a practice, learn a dedication in life, a commitment to not acting from, trying not to act from places of greed, hate, and delusion, then we're offering ourselves as a refuge to the world around us. If in addition to that, we're inspired to respond to the world, meet the world with our love, our compassion, our efforts to be peaceful, our efforts to meet each individual person with all the dignity and respect that everyone warrants. So to offer refuge, by taking refuge, we also, there's a feeling of offering refuge. As I said in the class that we had on refuge, I think clearly enough last Wednesday, that my way of offering refuges in the precepts here was really to confirm what's already in there for you in your hearts already. I didn't want to impose on you some idea or offer you some kind of commitment that I have. My understanding, this is the kind of commitment you make when you take refuge, and now you know you're accountable to that commitment, as if I'm going to state what that is. But rather, what I really wanted it to be was for you all to look in your own hearts and your own psyche and see what is it that resonates inside of you? What is it that's awakened inside of you in relationship to what we call the refuge of the Buddha, the refuge of the Dharma, and refuge of the Sangha? What is it that's awakened inside of you in relationship to these precepts? And then in recognizing that what is already your own, then to give voice to that, to give expression to that, to in a way that perhaps offers commitment, offers kind of a demarcation, say, yes, this is how I want to orient my life now. I'm going to try to live this way. This is an important way of living my life. Not because someone's telling me to, but because this is what's being born inside of me, what's being awakened inside of me. So in offering it that kind of way, it's actually a lot more difficult, I believe, than telling you, you know, this is what it means and you should follow this now. When I first went to practice Vipassana in Thailand, I'd done a Zen practice for many years. And in Zen practice, I'd practiced together with groups of people in Zendo and monastery. And it was kind of group practice. And the group practice was often emphasized. And my first 10-week retreat in Thailand, I was given a little kuti, a little cabin, a little hut on the edge of the monastery to practice in. And I was just told to go in there and do my walking meditation, do my sitting practice. There was no directions to go sit with anybody else. Go sit in the big Buddha hall, or the expectation was I just go sit there. And I found myself for the first time, hour after hour after hour, meditating by myself. And what I quickly discovered was that if I was going to be able to do it, I had to arouse within me a different level of commitment, dedication to the practice, than I had when I practiced together with other people. Because when I practiced with other people, there was a group support, which was really lovely. It was very important for me. I probably wouldn't have gone as far as I did without that group support. And the group support had many different elements to it. But it was kind of like, a little bit contagious, everybody else's motivation, and we kind of supported mine, or encouraged mine, or awakened mine. And a little bit the expectation that, when the bell rang in the morning, you showed up for the meditation hall with everybody else. And the fact that there was someone who took down attendance in the monastery, and if you didn't show up, they'd come and knock on your door and find out why. All these things were kind of, encouraging you to show up and be there. But in the monastery in Thailand, there was none of that. And I remember once I'd been there for a number of weeks practicing, and for some reason that I don't remember, I was wandering around the monastery. I was walking somewhere in the monastery, and it was really clear to me that the only thing I was supposed to be doing there was sitting and walking meditation in my little hut. So I was, breaking the schedule, that whatever schedule there was. And then who should be walking by but the abbot? And busted. And he looked at me, and he certainly saw me. It was just a wonderful way of being seen. You can imagine, I had this idea that I'd been busted and, I wasn't doing what I was supposed to do. And he saw me. And at the same time, I had a sense that he saw right through me. Well, not through me like he understood what was going on inside of me, but just like literally kind of, threw me to the trees on the other side. That he there was no judgment on his part. There was no criticism. He just saw me as a person who was walking down the path. And I'm sure he understood, what was going on, but that wasn't operating for him. There was this clarity, this purity, the way I was seen, that I had very seldom ever been seen by anybody that way. And there was no judgment at all from him that I was doing, breaking the schedule, doing something I wasn't supposed to be doing. I was just there. It was lovely. So, practicing there alone, I discovered that if I was going to keep up the practice, I had to be motivated within myself. All the motivation to practice had to be within myself. No one was particularly watching me. No one was demanding me to do anything. There wasn't a group expectation. It all had to come from myself. And in some ways, it's a lot harder to practice that way than practicing together with other people. Because of that, you have to find all the motivation, day after day after day. So the way that I'm offering you the refuge and the precepts is similar in that it really is your own motivation. And you have to rely on that for yourself. You have to find it in yourself. You have to awaken it for yourself and maintain it. I think it's, I've said it now a number of times, but I think it's actually quite a bit more difficult than the other kind of ways that you could do it, this kind of ceremony. But I think that's good. I mean, that's what I want it to be. Because I think it's a kind of growing up, a kind of maturation. I like to think of Dharma practice as practice of becoming adults. We all are. But adults in the sense of being able to become, in some ways, self-reliant. Not self-reliant necessarily that you do everything for yourself, but self-reliant in that you begin to know the practice of taking responsibility for where your heart's at and how your heart's relating to the world around you. So you're mindful. That's one of the reasons why mindfulness is such an important practice for us. Without mindfulness, how would you know where your heart's at? How would you know how your heart's reacting to the world around you? How would you know if there's greed in your heart or generosity? How would you know whether there's hate in your heart or love in your heart? How would you know whether there's clarity, understanding, or confusion? The mindfulness is what teaches you that. So we sit and look at the full moon night, and so much can stop. Sometimes sunrises and sunsets are the same way. We stop and just look. And I was reminded recently of when I was in college. I went to college at UC Santa Barbara for 2 years. And if you notice the coastline of Santa Barbara to where the university is, it kind of curves around so that if you stand on the edge of campus and the little point where it goes down to the ocean and look east, you kind of can see the sun rise out of the ocean because it curves around that far in the wintertime when the sun is kind of south. And it was December, and I was biking early in the morning to take my final exam for some class. And they had the system, because all the finals would happen within a few days of each other, that finals would start early in the morning and go into late in the evening, different classes. And I had an early morning final, and I was biking to campus along the cliffs, and the sun was rising. And I got off my bike and stood there and watched the sun rise out of the ocean. And then got on my bike and arrived at the final late. What was more important? So there's something very compelling about the sunrise, sunset, the full moon. And I'm emphasizing this because there's no necessarily meaning to it. It's kind of like almost like a biological thing. We stop, we're in awe, we look. So much of our self-preoccupation, so much of our concerns can kind of drop away in some simple way. So the same thing with the full moon, the luminosity of our own minds and hearts. That maybe it doesn't have to have any ultimate meaning beyond itself. But there's some way in which to live in its light, some way to be oriented towards it, to be developing it and moving into that direction, is compelling. It brings a sense of peace, contentment. It brings a sense of rightness to this world. So I hope that for each of you, that in your mindfulness practice, your Dharma practice, in going for refuge, my hope is that each of you has a strong sense of the possibility in engaging in the Dharma, of following this path to the full moon that you are, following the full moon of peace, luminosity, clarity that is already there inside of you. It's not something that has to be created so much. It's something that the obscurations from have to be taken, you know, fallen, have to be removed or quieted down. I hope that it's compelling, the movement towards this kind of peace. And not only for your own sake, but for the sake of everyone around you. I believe, it's my belief, and it isn't, you know, just emphasize, it's my belief, that sooner or later, it becomes impossible to continue in Dharma practice in some ongoing, committed way, unless you're also doing it for other people, for the welfare of others. And you might still spend a lot of time in mindfulness, going on retreats, which are kind of somewhat solitary, you know, maybe not talking to people on retreats. It's not obviously you're helping other people, but it's understood you're doing that partly for to be helpful to the world around you, to offer an alternative, to offer a different kind of heartfeltness to the world. So to go for refuge and to offer refuge, I think of being very similar. To receive the precepts, and then in turn to offer the precepts to the people you meet. They don't have to know you're offering it to them. Don't tell them that. They'll think you're on some kind of fanatical trip. But unless you're a teacher, then it's okay to tell you. But the idea of to receive the precepts, to receive the idea of an ethical life, a life of integrity, and then take that integrity of yours as if you're offering it to others so that they can find their own integrity. One of the small experiences in that first retreat in Thailand, there was wasn't much, you know, except that it had a big impact on me. And that is that I had been living in Japan before I went there. Right? That doesn't mean no matter where I was living, but I met this woman who I had was very attracted to, and I had lustful thoughts for her. And then, like Jimmy Carter. And then I went on this long retreat. And somewhere in the middle of the retreat, I hadn't thought about her. I didn't think about her for 4 or 5 weeks or something, or however long. And so in the middle of the retreat, somehow I remembered her. And the quality of my thoughts in my heart in thinking about her after these long periods of sitting was so qualitatively different than when I had before, when I had these lustful feelings for ideas for her and fantasies or whatever. And it was there was this purity in my heart, kind of very simple, kind of clean, very clean kind of thoughts about her, feelings for her, appreciation for who she was. And in a sense, I fell in love with that purity. It seemed so precious and so wonderful to feel myself freed from a lustful mind, and to feel a mind that was relating to someone else that felt really clean and beautiful. And I began, it was kind of the beginning of my really understanding of the value of the precepts. That the precepts, you know, certainly weren't a moralistic thou shalt kind of idea, but the precepts were an expression of that pure mind, that pure heart, that purity. When you would come from that purity, then the natural expression of that is that we don't kill, we don't steal, we don't lie, we don't involve ourselves in sexual misconduct, and we won't intoxicate the mind and the body. It's really clear to me we won't intoxicate the mind and body, because why would you ever want to mess with this phenomenally luminous clarity of mind if you've tasted it? I know that people want to do it when they don't taste it, because there's all kinds of reasons to do then. Sometimes because it's fun, you know, it's kind of pleasurable, and all kinds of reasons. You all know that. But if you're really living, if you go on like a 10-day retreat or something, and it tastes, you know, some real, or sit and meditate and taste some real clarity of mind, you probably have the experience that, you know, that any intoxication is a lessening, a dampening down, a closing down of it. So it's not a moralistic thing. It's just like it's obvious that this is how you'd live your life. It makes me very happy, actually, very happy to be here with you and talk about this, because it kind of reawakens, reminds me of, for myself, of how much value and love I feel for Dharma, for the refuges, for the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. And to know that there are people who, in some way, I haven't feel the same way. I feel a little bit sad that I wasn't able to kind of eavesdrop on all your little conversations during the class, to hear how you each talked personally about the questions I asked you to talk about. But I love sitting here and feeling the atmosphere in the room, and I bow to all of you, and great appreciation for what you've found and what you've done with your lives, and that the fact that this Dharma practice and Dharma teachings has meaning for you, and you found some way that resonates with inside of you. It makes me really happy. It makes me happy, at least, to offer to you this way, where I'm not offering you anything, but rather offering, you know, in a sense, giving you a chance to really acknowledge, commit yourself, orient yourself to what I hope has already been awakened in your own hearts. And I hope that as you go forth from this day and onwards, that that which has been awakened, maybe just an intuition now, will get stronger and stronger and become something that really becomes a phenomenal, stable support for your life, something you carry with you wherever you go. So as for the ceremony now, what I'd like us to do is to take a short break. I'd like us to do it in silence for about 5 minutes or so. You need to go to the bathroom, whatever. And then at some point, when you're ready to come back and sit down, then come up here with your candle. You everybody hopefully has two candles who's going to be part of the ceremony. If you don't have two candles, I think someone, maybe Meryl or someone, brought some extra. So you can, but bring, we'll take one of your candles. The first candle is going to, you're going to offer it to the Buddha. And there's a tradition of, in Buddhism, of making offerings. And the candle is, especially back in the ancient times when people didn't have lights and electricities, light was not only symbolic of the light of the mind, light of enlightenment, but it was also a very precious thing to offer light in a situation where you didn't have electricity was a big deal. And so when you're offering, when you bring candles to the Buddha, you're offering light, both literal and symbolically. So it's an offering that you're going to make to the Buddha. And so come up here and then light your candle off the candle on the altar. And then place your lit candle here on this table here. And perhaps what you should do is start near the back so that we don't want to fill up the front first so people have to lean over yours and burn their sleeves. And then if you like, at that point you can bow to the Buddha and what the Buddha symbolizes or means for you. And then take one of these protection cords. And just take it and just bring it back to your seat and put it in front of you where you're sitting or put it in your lap. And then when everyone's done that, then we will start the ceremony.